Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So today we're going to be discussing a very short sutta, but one of the reasons I've selected this sutta today, as I mentioned on a Friday night, that I've been trying to look through the list of suttas which I haven't talked about, and which other monks have not talked about, or nuns, and that's why I came across this sutta today, which we haven't, according to the list which I've got, haven't talked about yet. And one of the reasons why we don't talk about some suttas is because they're either very long, or they're very short, or they're a bit sort of confusing and very hard to get some understanding of. So this one over here is very short. But nevertheless, it's quite meaningful. And just to add some interest to it, I've got the second sutta here, which will elaborate on an important, very subtle point of the teachings, which is going to come up at the end. So here we go, sutta number 59. I just wait till everyone settles down. The many kinds of feeling. And again, it's just to give an overview before we start. There's two main parts to this. First of all, a point that when the Buddha teaches the Dhamma, sometimes you look at it from different angles. I sometimes call it different frameworks. And it's not that one framework is right and the other one is wrong. It's not that even one framework for understanding is better than another framework. It just really depends upon the context. And so a lot of times people can argue over different parts of the teachings. Well, this doesn't seem to be the same as that part of the teachings. But what the Buddha is really saying is that it really depends upon your angle. The truth is not really sort of able to be defined black and white. It depends on which angle you look at it from. And the other part is the nature of happiness. And this is an important part of Buddhism because it's one of the reasons why people do become monks and stay monks, why people come here in order to discover what real happiness truly is. And you've heard me many times before talking about the meditations as a bliss better than sex. And this gives some textual authority to what I'm saying. And not only that, but it gives you an understanding of what drives you into deep meditation, and the most important thing at the very end, why people actually say that Nibbana is the highest happiness, and what actually is this Nibbana which is the highest happiness? And this gives you some understanding of that. So here we go. Short but very deep sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Then the carpenter, Panchanganga, which means five tools, went to the Venerable Udayin, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him. So this is the layperson asking the monk. Venerable sir, how many kinds of feeling have been stated by the Blessed One? Now, by the word feeling, it doesn't mean the same as the English word where we have a feeling in the body, nor does it mean the same as the emotional, you know, your feelings. The feeling is a specific word here, meaning the type of pleasure or pain or beauty and happiness which you experience through the senses. And this will become a little bit more obvious in a few moments. And the monk replies, three kinds of feeling have been stated by the Blessed One, householder. Pleasant feeling, painful feeling, and neither pleasant nor painful feeling. These three kinds of feeling have been stated by the Blessed One, the Buddha. And when it says pleasant, that means pleasant in any of the six senses, you know, which is, if it's through the sense of sight, we call it beauty. Through the sense of sound, we call it harmonious or whatever. And through the sense of smell, fragrant, and delicious, through the sense of taste, and of course pleasure through the sense of touch, and maybe happiness or bliss through the sense of mind. So in English we have a different word for pleasure or for this happy feeling, dependent upon which of the six senses it is. Yeah. Monk, yeah. Pleasure. As a householder, you're having a wonderful day. You feel happy. So, sometimes you feel depressed. So, where is, say, the pain of depression? Where is that? Or you feel angry. That's an unpleasant mental feeling. Because it's not your eyes are angry, or your ears are angry, or your nose is angry. Even if you've got hay fever, still, it doesn't really make you angry. Even though it's an unpleasant feeling. So it is feelings in the mind here. But again, just as we go on, it'll be a little bit clearer. So the monk says there are three types of feelings. Pleasant, painful, and neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And the carpenter replies, not three kinds of feelings have been stated by the Blessed One, Venerable Dain. Two kinds of feeling have been stated by the Blessed One, pleasant feeling and painful feeling. This neither painful nor pleasant feeling has been stated by the Blessed One as a peaceful and sublime kind of pleasure. So this equanimity, he said, is pleasurable. And the second and the third time, the Venerable Dain stated his position. And the second and the third time, the carpenter, Panchanganga, stated his. And the Venerable Dain could not convince the carpenter, Panchakanga, nor could the carpenter, Panchakanga, convince the Venerable Dain. So they had an argument. And the Venerable Ananda heard their conversation. He went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down on one side and reported to the Blessed One the entire conversation between the monk Udayan and the carpenter Panchakanga. When he had finished, the Blessed One told the Venerable Ananda, Ananda, it was actually a true presentation that the carpenter Panchakanga would not accept from Udayan, and it was a true presentation that Udayan would not accept from the carpenter Panchakanga. In other words, they were both right. I have stated two kinds of feeling in one presentation, have stated three kinds of feeling in another presentation. I have stated five kinds of feeling in another presentation. I have stated six kinds of feeling in another presentation. I have stated 18 kinds of feeling in another presentation. I have stated 36 kinds of feeling in another presentation. I have stated 108 kinds of feelings in yet another presentation. That is how the Dhamma has been shown by me in different presentations. It's just like our Prime Minister Kevin Rudd sometimes. He said, well, you said this today, but you said something else yesterday. It's just he should say, but ABC, I had one presentation yesterday, and this is said in another presentation today. They're both right. Now, the point is that some people always got fault-finding minds, but here there's a very important point. It depends upon the type of presentation. What is the purpose of what you're trying to get at? And it depends upon the purpose. Then you have all these different types of feelings. So you can't point it down. The Buddha just said two, they just said five or whatever. So that's one of the important things. Please don't argue about the Dhamma. If somebody says one thing and somebody says another thing, you're probably both right. So is any question about that? And that's why something what you said, are we talking about the mental feelings as well? Is just the five feelings of the five senses, or is it the 18 feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, and in between, times six for each different type of feeling? And if you look at the note here, the 616, I think that someone's gone to the trouble of finding out sort of where in the suttas all these different numbers come from. So you can work it out, but you can do that by yourself. But now, the next paragraph is important. When the Dhamma, the teaching, has thus been showed by me in different presentations, it may be expected of those who will not concede, allow, and accept what is well stated and well spoken by others, now the people who don't accept these other people's sayings, that they will take to quarreling, brawling and disputing, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. That's a beautiful simile which is often in Buddhism, like verbal daggers. So knowing that these things will really hurt each other. Stabbing each other with verbal daggers. But it may be expected of those who concede, allow, and accept what is well stated and well spoken by others, that they will live in concord, with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. So there's different interpretations, you know, even within Theravada, even the forest tradition. But we can actually look at that as just people using different frameworks. And there are different interpretations between all the different types of Buddhism, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. But instead of just saying, oh, what you're saying is wrong, if something is well stated and well spoken, then concede it. It's good. It makes sense. But we don't go around not conceding anything which our enemies say, because they're not of our sect, they're not of our church, they don't belong to us, and go around quarreling, brawling, disputing, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. Because there's too much of that in religion already. And there's too much of that even within religion. And it comes very much so in particular sects of one particular religion. It seems to be the sort of the closer you are, the more people tend to quarrel. So this is a very strong statement by the Buddha, that just because what another person says you don't agree with, they may be seeing it from a different presentation, a different angle, so don't necessarily argue with them. Any comments about that? Okay. Now we go on to the deeper part of the teachings. And this is where he goes on to the different types of pleasure. Ananda, there are these five causes of sensual pleasure. Now, first of all, that I was just discussing with Ajahn Brahmadi recently, because he's been going through the new translation of the Anguttara Nikaya. And the particular word here, which is translated as sensual pleasure, he has a very strong argument, and I agree with him 100%, that the best translation of that word is not sensual pleasure, but sense objects. For those of you who are interested, the word is karma, K-long-A-M-A, and in the singular it is always looked upon as being a desire. But in the plural, that's actually where we get the old, remember from when I was a kid, the Kama Sutra, all about sort of sensory desire. That's the same word, karma, K-long-A-M-A, all about sexuality and other sense pleasures. But when it's used in the plural, and this is a plural form here, it's always sense objects. And especially the objects just of the five senses. In Buddhism, it was if you read these things in the Pali, it becomes very clear, and it's a very important part of the Buddhist philosophy, which doesn't come out in English, that they made a complete distinction between the five external senses, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and the sixth sense of the mind. Always acknowledging there were six senses. But the objects of those five senses, they're called karma, K-long-A-M-A. Nothing to do with karma of action and result, but karma. So they're the five causes or the five types of sense objects. Now that's what it really should say here, not really pleasure. What are the five? Forms cognizable by the eye. Obviously these are the objects of the senses. That are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. Sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongues, and tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, connected with sensual desire, and provocative of lust. These are the five causes of sensual pleasure. Now, the five causes of sensual objects. Now, the pleasure and joy that arise dependent upon these five chords of sensual objects are called sensual happiness or sensual pleasure. Now, remember, these are the objects of the five senses, and they are separated out in Buddhism from the feelings connected to the mind. Now, that is very important because when you talk about sensual pleasure, it never has anything to do with the pleasure of the mind, but very much to do with the pleasure of the body. Because later on, we have the pleasures of the body being something we should push aside in favor of the pleasures of the mind. In fact, for those of you who know your Buddhism, in the first teaching of the Buddha, the Who knows what the first teaching of the Buddha was? No, well, sort of. What was the first teaching of the Buddha? Now, you, Daddy, you've listened to me so often, you get it right. This is sometimes a trick question, because many people say the first teaching of the Buddha was the first sermon, which was all about Four Noble Truths. But the very beginning of that sermon was all about the middle way, to avoid the two extremes. And the first extreme is Kama Sukha. This is the sensory pleasure, the pleasures of the five senses. Kama Sukha, Ali Kanu Yoga, means like just to being attached to the smear of those five sense objects. So he said that's one of the extremes, getting into the five senses. And the other one is also really interesting, Atta Gilamatanu Yoga. And Anu Yoga means again, sort of indulging in. And Atta is the same as Anatta, yourself, Kinamata, which means whatever tires and wearies you. He said, whatever tires and wearies you, or indulging in sort of these objects of the five senses, those are the two extremes. Now that makes it far more precise. Because when you hear about the middle way, sometimes people have all sorts of weird ideas of what the middle way is. The middle way means, well, you don't give up alcohol. You don't take alcohol, you just have one glass. That's the middle way. And of course, that's not the middle way at all. Sort of, what the middle way is, very precise, anything to do with the five sense objects, you sort of abandon that. You let it go as much as you possibly can. Anything which tires and wearies you, you let that go as well. So even to the point of going without sleep, forcing yourself, being ascetic for the point that that wearies the body and loses your energy, especially Atta Gilamata, wearies your inner energy. That's what you've got to watch out for. Go on. Indeed, sometimes the happiness or the ill will about the mind, which is now based on the five sense objects, in other words, yeah, you see an ugly sort of person, maybe not sort of ugly physically, because they, you know, you don't like seeing them because they may be someone you owe lots of money to, so you don't like seeing them. So that gives you a sense of tension in the mind, but that actually is, if you like, based as a reaction to the five sense world. That's right, the sixth sense. Sometimes there is a reaction there, the sixth sense reacts to what the five senses experience. You know that there's some proliferation. You see something you like, I want that, how can I get it? But the real pleasures of the mind, these are going to be what's coming up when the five senses disappear. So that type of pleasure and happiness of the mind is just so caught up with the five senses that we might as well just call it part of the five senses. So that there are these five sense objects, just gone to them, and that's called, and any pleasure dependent on those five sense objects is called sensual pleasure. So if it's dependent upon that, in other words, you get joy because it's a really delicious cup of tea you had today, then even that, you can say, well, that's a sort of mental pleasure because it's joy, but it's bound up with the five senses. That's why it's called five sense pleasure. Or if it's five sense unhappiness, you know, because, you know, you find out that, you know, somebody has scratched your new car, you know, you get really upset. Sure, that upset is a mental defilement, but it's dependent upon the five sense objects because you saw something you didn't really like to see. That's why it's called sensual pleasure, the Kama Sukha. So I always say this: the sensual pleasure, called sensual pleasure, the Kama Sukha, that is the word which is repeated as the first of the extremes we avoid by the middle way. So we're not caught up with, you know, the pleasures and the pains. which come about for the five sense objects. We avoid them. You don't get caught up with them. You can't avoid them because you will see things which are beautiful and things which are ugly. You'll smell fragrance and sometimes you'll smell things which are very stinky. And I still remember, he's not here today. Many of you know old Brian Creek. Brian Creek, he used to be a ranger. Every Friday he would always bring some flowers for the shrine. And one day he brought some flowers and he must have had a cold that day. Because he brought one of these flowers which smelt like dog poo. And it did. And I walked in there and I just couldn't believe that. I thought somebody had trodden the dog poo and put their sandals somewhere because it really stunk out the whole room. And I was trying to find it. I looked at all the shoes. There was no dog poo in the shoes. And it was really sort of, where is it? And what you do, you smell and find out where the smell comes from. And it followed its smell. It was from this flower. And I couldn't believe it was the first time I saw that Western Australian flower, which is pollinated by flies, not by bees. And poor old Brian had brought it that day. Good job he never offered it to the Buddha. I caught him before he did that. And it looked beautiful. It's a beautiful yellow flower, but it smelled really sort of terrible. So, even so sometimes you have pleasant and unpleasant, but it's all caught up with the five senses. So, now paragraph 7, and this is a great sort of, not many religions actually go for this because they don't understand sort of the meditation. Should anyone say, that is the utmost pleasure and joy that beings experience, the pleasure and joy coming from the five senses, I would not concede that to him. Why is that, says the Buddha? Because there is another kind of pleasure, loftier, or I've got in pencil here, more excellent and more sublime than that pleasure. And what is that other kind of pleasure? Here Ananda, quite secluded from the five sense objects, take off sensual pleasures there, quite secluded from the five sense objects, secluded from the unwholesome states, which are the five hindrances. A monk, nun, layman, laywoman, remember he's talking to monks here, that's why he mentions a monk here, enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by the movement of the mind onto the object and staying with the object, with a rapture and pleasure born of seclusion from the five senses. That is the other kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the previous pleasure, which is the pleasure of the five senses. So straight away here, the Buddha is actually saying, if anyone says, the highest happiness, the most beautiful happiness is having, amazing sex, or shooting up heroin, or seeing the birth of your first child, being pleasant for that, or seeing sort of the Amazon rainforest in the misty morning, whatever else which you say is the most amazing pleasure, or listening to Beethoven's Fifth, played by the Berlin Philharmonic. The Buddha was saying, I don't concede that. There's another pleasure, more lofty and more excellent. He says, this is the first jhana. And so, straight away, from sayings like this, which occur many times in the suttas, this is where I have my textual justification by saying these jhanas are a pleasure better than sex. Because that's the pleasure which most people know. And for a lot of people, not everybody, some people are much more refined, but a lot of people in society take that as one of the highest pleasures. Yes. Both. It doesn't really matter which way you understand it, but the pleasure depending upon some suffering which is disappearing is the whole theme of the second sutta which we're going to read out today, which comes from the Anguttara Nikaya. So again, I never want to not answer person's questions, but I'm going to just delay that until we come to the last part of this reading today, and then I think you'll find a very beautiful answer. But here, it's very common that people who do even get into, not even jhanas yet, but get into some peaceful meditation, they do experience some joy. And straight away, Buddha's making you realize here that that is natural, that is what's supposed to happen. There's nothing wrong with that. Please enjoy it. Because you actually say, this is what happens here. And sometimes people think, my goodness, I'm meditating, I'm getting happy, there must be something wrong. And I think that might come by the fact if people think the religion or spiritual practice must always be painful. And that the more no pain, no gain, as they say. But that doesn't happen at all in Buddhism. The meditation is supposed to be peaceful, it's supposed to be joyful. And the more joy you have, the more better you are meditating. So it gets to the point here that that joy, allow it to get big, because it's going to get to the point, and hopefully each one of you one day will experience these jhanas, you'll get to the point where it's much more excellent, much more lofty than any pleasure which is based on the five senses. In other words, the best pleasure you've ever experienced in your existence. Okay, this is what's going to happen. And this is actually what happens. So many people become Buddhists, you know, because they touch these deep meditations, think, my God, what was that? And this is the best pleasure you've ever had in your whole life. And of course, that is very attractive. And I don't mind using that as a marketing tool for Buddhism. You know, this meditation, it really gets you into some amazing pleasures. But also, it's getting you to understand what pleasures truly are. So sometimes people say, oh, you monks, you know, you just do this just because you're stuffed up, you're afraid of pleasures. I say, no. We really know what pleasure truly is. I'm a good time monk. I'm really into pleasure. And saying it like that makes people look at Buddhism in a different way. Because the idea of like monks in the West, especially, monks in the West are these people who whip themselves, who stay in like cold cells, you know, with mold on the walls, you know, people who just, you know, wear sackcloth and ashes, you know, which and wear these belts with, needles or sharp things poking into their flesh. And they think that's what a monk is supposed to do. And, you know, because that's Christian ascetic monks. But, you know, here there's a totally different scheme of things. Of letting go of those five sense objects so you can get sort of an even greater pleasure. No, not at that particular time, nor afterwards. You can conclude they haven't got jhana. Yeah. Now, this is one of the problems. This is a good question. Thank you, Cheng. It's for a long time in Western Buddhism that jhanas were things, that lay people, you know, you got busy, you've got to go to work, you know, you can't get these jhanas. So a lot of times people didn't even talk about jhanas. And I was told by some of the Vietnamese disciples here that about 30 or 40 years ago, could be 20 years, could be 60 years ago, the monks in Vietnam just banned lay people from reading about the jhana books. And they sort of hid them away from them. No, literally. Because they thought, it's just a waste of time, just confuse our lay community. And the Vietnamese Buddhism was very, very good and very strong, but that's what they decided. It was interesting. But the last 10 or 15 years, we've been starting talking about jhanas. That's one of the things which I started to do. And you know, I'm one of those ones on the forefront of teaching jhanas to everybody. But because you start teaching them, and because it's out there, some people want these jhanas so much that they lower the entrance requirements. So, you know, you've heard me teach so many times, Cheng, and you know that when I talk about jhanas, it's very clear, no thinking, you've got no five senses, you can't hear things at all. And you know, that's certainly how I understand through these sutras and experience what these jhanas are like. But because of people want these jhanas so much these days, they've lowered the standards. I was talking with Joseph Goldstein a few years ago with his senior teachers, and they're calling what they're experiencing jhana light, L-I-T-E. You know, which wasn't really the jhanas, I've got to say. But, you know, they wanted it so much. They're saying, well, they're sort of almost jhanas. Not really. They could still think, they could still hear.
I'm just trying to shoot a bit
now. Yeah.
I am not condemning sexual activities either. Yeah. It's just a part of sexual pleasure. I'm married.
Yeah. It is a twisted tactic. I agree with you there. Simply because, you know, after you've come out of a jhana, if you had jhanas recently, you know, you've got this very high type of pleasure, and you don't really need the other type of pleasure of sexuality or going to movies or being excited in those senses. Because you see that they're not just one is more delicious than the other. It's just you can't have both at the same time. Because one of them, so the sexuality, the sensuality, the being out there with those five senses, actually gets you stuck in that five sense world, and you can't let it go to get into the jhanas.
So shift a bit more, because it seems like as the public get more into doing religious practice, at the same time, people are cherry picking the old culture, and it becomes a situation where I find that people are encouraged.
I had sex before I became a monk, so I know that the sexual act is not a calm procedure. I think all of you, would agree with that. You know, you're sort of really caught up, very excited, and it's the excitement which is a pleasure there. So you never call it calm. But I think a lot of times people try and get the best of both worlds. But anyone who actually says that, they're just basically haven't got a clue what they're talking about. So, but you know, monks come along and say, no way, you know, if you've got jhanas, you're just not interested in sex. And they say, there we go again, you're a monk who needs to get a life. But nevertheless, I don't mind saying that. So, one or the other. So, that's down to paragraph 8. Should anyone say about the first jhana, that is the utmost pleasure and joy that beings experience, I would not concede that to him. Why is that? Because there is another kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the pleasure of the first jhana. And what is that other kind of pleasure? It's the second jhana. Here Ananda, with the stilling of this movement of the mind onto the object, and in the first jhana the object is your bliss. If you ask yourself afterwards what you were aware of, you're aware of that particular type of bliss, that particular flavor of pleasure called first jhana. And that when that movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object subsides, then you enter upon abiding a second jhana, which has internal, not self-confidence. Self-confidence is no sense of a self anymore. Internal confidence and unification of mind. Without this movement of the mind, that unification of mind, when the mind doesn't move, that's that stillness. And the reason why it is still, because one of the things which has dropped away there is your will, your ability to choose. That means that it's absolutely still. It cannot be moved. If you can choose, if you can exercise will, it means you can move. So this is one of those cases where you're totally still. And that's why it's called the unification of mind, the singleness of mind, with the rapture and pleasure which are born of, again, not concentration, but stillness. And for a long time, many of you know that I prefer stillness to the word concentration, because concentration does imply some effort, some willpower. And that's totally absent at this particular stage. So this is the other kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the previous pleasure. So straight away, the first jhana, you've gone to this mental pleasure, you know, much better than the sexual act or anything else you've known before. And then you go deeper. And you don't go deeper as willpower, just something which is a disturbance settles down. In the same way, I often say, you know, when you've got a sort of a cup and it's moving in the top, you let it go and the waves start to settle down and they disappear. You don't do anything to make those waves settle down, you just let it go and it settles down. In the same way, you don't do anything to get from, say, a first jhana to a second jhana, you just leave it alone. And then those waves of this movement of the mind onto the object or holding onto the object, what is said here to be applied in sustained thought, it's a very bad translation, what is said there settles down by itself. You just let go and just don't do anything. So a lot of times, the longer you stay in the first jhana, the more chance it is that you evolve, or usually involve, into a second jhana. And there you get even a higher pleasure. Now, for those of you who like to compare these spiritual practices outside of Buddhism, you know, there are some indications that some of the Christian mystics, like Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, did actually enter these jhanas. Now, I read some of their descriptions of their experiences, and some of them is like dead ringers. Yeah, that was a jhana, but other things they say, that's a bit off. So we actually never really know, because it's, what is that, about 600, 700, 800 years ago. And it's very hard to rely upon the translations of what they said. However, you know, my sort of guess is actually they did get into these jhanas, but what they called it was a union with God. Now, what does it actually mean by a union with God, and why did they say that? Now, you can imagine here, their five senses is totally gone. So their inability to hear, to see, even to feel their own body. And they've gone to this incredible bliss, which is a much higher pleasure than anything they've known in the world. Now, that degree of pleasure and power and the unity there, if a person had no experience of Buddhism and no sort of knowledge about these jhana states, I can understand that's what they would say that was. Incredible power, bliss. You know, a lot of times that people in those states call it they've unified with pure love. And you may understand that the experience of that bliss, that's another way that we'd interpret it. Because, you know, the pure love is sometimes the highest of blisses. I mean, really intense pleasure, mental pleasure, becomes almost the same as our perception of pure and absolute love. And to people who have experienced those stages, it becomes quite obvious why a person who is a theist who believes in an ultimate being would actually say, yeah, that first jhana is that state of unification with the God. The pleasure, the power, the absence of self are the indications which a Christian mystic would say, yeah, that was a unity with God. Which is an interesting thing there. And apparently, according to the sayings of Teresa of Avila, that when she would get into her ecstasy, she would actually levitate. And the nun staying with her would have to hold her by the feet to stop her floating up to the ceiling. And that's literally, that's what it says. So that's interesting. And of course, that would obviously come with such powers. But if you go further through those jhanas and go to the second jhana, then the idea of unity with God will disappear. So now you're going into some high pleasure states, which is why that there was a group of Western Christian monks and nuns, and they would obviously go into the ecstasies, and to them that spiritual union was spiritual ecstasy. And that's where that type of mysticism, now we have sort of understand how that works in Buddhism. These are the ecstasy states, the spiritual ecstasy states. Why spiritual ecstasy? You've disappeared. Your body, your five senses have gone. Your will has almost disappeared in first jhana, certainly in the second jhana. It's not you anymore. Nothing you can recognize as a self. And so you think you've submerged into the divine. Yeah. Hindu mysticism as well. But the only thing which I know from that was one man who was studying for many years with Swami Muktananda at his ashram just north of Sydney, not far from Wat Buddhadhamma. There was a big ashram up there which he had for many, many years. I think it's all fallen apart now. But he was with him, and when I was asking about their meditation, this may not be sort of Hindu, total Hindu, but this was Swami Muktananda, who was a very prominent expositor of Hinduism in the West. So he was telling me about his meditation of going into meditation where he saw a blue nimitta. He called it the blue pearl nimitta. And you know, it was one of these nimittas, these lights in the mind when everything else disappeared. And then he said the goal, as far as he knew, Swami Muktananda's teaching, was to merge into that blue nimitta, and that would be the union with the Brahman. And if that was accurate to the teachings, and I cannot say it was accurate because I just got this from a disciple, then that would be the jhana states again. So now we've got the second jhana. And for anyone who's experienced these states, I mean, you're just really blissing out real big time now. The first jhana is a bigger bliss than you've ever had before, which is why when you come out of these states, you know, you don't just come out, oh, yeah, I just had a first jhana, let's have a cup of tea. No, you're just in another world. You know, you're just blissed out. So which is why that sometimes people think you might have gone crazy. Which is great that I talk like this, because then you know that people are just really so sensitive and just, you know, sometimes you can hardly talk to them. What do you want? Oh. Because they just come out of a very, very high state of deep pleasure. So the idea of like having sex afterwards, it's just a crazy idea. So you're in a very deep, powerful state. So if you do ever see anyone, there was one man who had a very deep meditation here many years ago, and I was very proud of one of the people sitting in this room now, that when he actually came out, that she looked after him perfectly, just took him to a quiet place, almost like a recovery room, so he could actually come down into sort of this world outside after getting a very deep meditation. That's what you have to do. So that's only the first jhana. The second jhana is a pleasure which is of another level to the first jhana. And when you start doing these things, you think, gee, where does this all end? And you're really getting into some incredible blisses and ecstasies. So, the second jhana, this is much higher than the previous one. And the Buddha says, should anyone say that this is the utmost pleasure and joy that beings experience, I will not concede that to him. A lot of times if you experience these things, you kind of comprehend that there could be a pleasure or a bliss higher than this. Which is again one of the reasons why people sometimes they get into these jhanas, they think this is enlightenment. You know, they've gotten to the utmost. And that is one of the dangers, one of the reasons why the Buddha says a sutta like this. Because again, you go into incredible power, a lot of energy, amazing bliss. You think this must be nirvana. No, not yet. He said, I do not concede that there is this is the utmost pleasure and joy. Because with the fading away as well of the rapture, which is like half of the bliss inside this second jhana state. And what this actual word rapture means, you can't know until you've got into that state of third jhana. Because basically that what's missing is a deeper pleasure, a more delicious pleasure, and what's missing, that was what that rapture was. A meditator abides in equanimity, mindful and fully aware. Now, often we mention that, this is the third jhana, you are mindful and fully aware. Sometimes people say, these meditations, trances, are the same as hypnosis or same as sleep. Mindful and fully aware, mindful and fully aware. In all of these states, you know, your mindfulness is very, very strong. So you're super awake, you're not dull at all. Focused, but not at all sleepy. It's not a trance, but a heightened state of awareness. In the third jhana, on the count of which the noble ones announce they have a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and mindful. This is that other kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the previous pleasure. Should anyone say that this is the utmost kind of pleasure, I will not concede of them. There's one which is more superior. And what is that other kind of pleasure? Here, Ananda, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, which is the pleasure and pain concerned with the five external senses, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, which is the pleasure and lack of pleasure concerned with the mind, a monk enters upon the abode in the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. That is the other kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the previous pleasure. Now here you get a lot of problems with your language, because here all the pleasures has disappeared. So perfect stillness and equanimity, that which was the bliss before, has totally disappeared. And you're totally poised, absolutely still, nothing going on, the deepest peace you've ever experienced. At the time, you know, you don't have got a clue that that could be pleasurable. When you come out of it, it's the most peaceful thing I've ever had in my whole life. And you understand it's another form of pleasure, the pleasure of perfect peace. Now, what we're doing here is understanding just how many different types of pleasures there are and what real pleasure truly is. You've gone through some of the highest of pleasures, and you come to the equanimity. Instead of equanimity, let's call it peace, because peace is something which we can have some understanding of. Equanimity, too often that's a negative thing in our world. You're just sitting there, you're not doing anything. You should get involved. There's problems in the world. Do something. But peace is something which is valued, is understood enough in its coarsest form to get you to have an understanding of what this fourth jhana truly is. Incredible, deep, stable, unmoving peace for long, long periods of time. Now that is a pleasure which is higher than all these other jhanas. We're getting an understanding of what real pleasure, contentment, if you like, happiness, what this word happiness, pleasure, truly is all about. Any comments so far? Aha, that's again not a very good translation again. With the body, it's just experiencing it for himself. This is an idiom. In the same way that when you first were studying English overseas, you see that in Australia it sometimes rains cats and dogs. And a person who doesn't know what they're, hasn't got a good English teacher, might really think that cats and dogs fall from the sky whenever there's a rainstorm. This is just like an idiom. And this is feeling pleasure with the body. It means this experiencing the pleasure for yourself. It's not with a physical body. If they experience it with the body, it's kaya pati sangvedi. And that means it's a personal experience. So even personal experience, you've got no person there, it's not a self or a soul. But the idea of a personal experience, direct experience, that is what the word feeling with the body means. And that's, again, it's not a very accurate translation. Again, you can ask Ajahn Bhamari, and he's totally on side with me this one. Kaya Pati Sangvedi means you experience it yourself. So, what I would say there, where is it? Still feeling pleasure with your own experience would be a best translation. So this is not sort of just the theory anymore, this is direct experience. And still having a direct experience of pleasure, that would be even a better translation. Having direct experience of pleasure. Now that comes to that fourth jhana of total stillness. Oh yes, you had one, yeah? It's not for you within that jhana, so because this is just an observation through experience that time is very much caught up with your desires, your cravings, your wanting. When desires and wanting disappears, actually the perception of time vanishes for you. So remember, in these deep meditations, you're so still, there's no movement, there's no wanting. So there's no way that you, through your own experience, can measure time. You haven't got a clue about the passing of time. But still, like, time happens even though you're not counting those minutes. So that, you know, you do open your eyes sometime later and see that many hours have passed by. And, you know, it's a sign it was a very deep meditation, it lasted very long, because these are incredibly stable states. So because they're stable, you just stay in there for long periods of time, and there's no reason to come out. You're having a wonderful time, and you can't do anything anyway. Sometimes you're just stuck in those states. You know that story which I told about that Vietnamese monk recently who came to Australia, who, you know, doing the 9-day meditation retreat. I think I told that on the retreat. You haven't heard that one? There's a Vietnamese monk who came to Australia. He didn't want his name to be known. But he started the 9-day meditation retreat, the same as we do over here. You know, in the Friday evening, you know, people just settle in and then do a half an hour meditation together, and after the half an hour meditation, he's going to give the opening talk. But after an hour, he still hadn't come out of his meditation, just sitting there. You know, another hour and a half, still hadn't sort of opened his eyes to start the evening talk, so everyone was getting a bit restless, what's going on? And just one by one, they just left and went to bed and left him sitting there. In the morning, he was still sitting there. He didn't move for 9 days. Just sat there, never went to the toilet, never ate, never did anything, just sitting there like a Buddha statue. And afterwards, when he came out, he sort of apologized, said, "I'm terribly sorry, I just got in one of these very deep meditations, I just couldn't come out." And just the time passed. And the people there said, "No, no, no need to apologize, that's wonderful, just seeing you is better than any talk." So it does happen. So just sat there for 9 whole days, apparently. I don't know, it could have been 7 or 8, I forget now. But he was didn't even move, day and night. So they still make monks like that these days. Yeah. Yeah? Well, look, if it's a first jhana, maybe like half an hour or an hour, if you say you've got a... Yeah, okay, I'll accept that. If it's a fourth jhana, it must be at least 4 or 5 hours, at least. Could have been, you're so still, having the time of your life. You don't get yourself give that away. Yeah, well, I say just at minimum. But let's just see what happens. I mean, these are powerful states, okay? This is, we're going to, you know, really sort of big-time spiritual experiences here. But I don't mind talking about these because people, lay people, just like you, sometimes actually do it. So, good on you, why not? They did it in the time of the Buddha, why not now? Now we haven't even finished yet. Should anyone say that... that is the utmost pleasure and joy that beings experience, I would not concede that to them. And if anyone's experienced these things, they go, Jesus Buddha, what's he up to? There can't be any bliss higher than that. I said, yeah, sure there is. By completely transcending the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness, instead of infinite, is without bounds. A person enters upon abides in the base of infinite consciousness. This is that other kind of pleasure, lofty and more sublime than the previous one. Infinite consciousness... I forgot infinite space first of all, I missed one out. So let's go back to number 11. Here and under, with a complete surmounting of perceptions of form and the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware, just with the awareness that space is unbounded, a monk enters upon and abides in the base of the unbounded space. That is the other kind of pleasure, lofty and more sublime than the previous pleasure. Now, what we actually really mean here, I mentioned this metaphor in Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, that for many of your experiences meditating, and going back to the idea of the perception of time, you just get into the present moment. And in the present moment, that's usually when your perception of time starts to disappear. You're in this moment, and many of you, you haven't got jhanas yet, but 35, 45 minutes went past already? Gee, that couldn't have been. Because you're in this present moment, and in the present moment, you're not measuring time. So in the present moment, like time becomes unbounded. You're not measuring it anymore. And this is an experience of what happens, because time begins to vanish. Space begins to vanish for you here. This is one of the things which can define consciousness. Space. So it's got nothing to watch anymore. I'm not talking about physical space. I mean, if you might like call conscious space, mind space, begins to vanish. And this vanishing of the mind space is even more peaceful when you've got nothing to watch. But nothing is, again, just like pleasure, has got many different levels of nothing. Because you don't want to say that first, what they call immaterial state, or vanishing state, is the highest. I will not concede that, because there's another type of pleasure, even more pleasurable than that. And that's when, aware that consciousness is boundless, in other words, is vanishing. A monk enters upon and abides in the base of, I'm going to call it now, vanishing consciousness. That is the other kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the other pleasure. In the fourth jhana, you're so still. And as I mentioned before, it's just the nature, not just of the brain, but the nature of the mind as well, will only be able to notice things which move. So you can imagine having an object which is absolutely so still, and I'm really talking about still, nothing is moving at all. Some of it's going to vanish. When it does, that becomes the first vanishing, becomes the first immaterial state, where the mind space, conscious space, vanishes. When the conscious space vanishes, you think there's nothing left. There's still consciousness, but now consciousness vanishes. And that's the second immaterial, because there's no movement going on. In the third state, you say that is the utmost pleasure and joy that beings experience. I would not concede that to him. Straight away you think, my goodness, can you call that pleasure and joy? And the Buddha said, now that really is pleasure and joy. It's making like the idea more like of contentment, something which is even more peace, being the highest pleasure. And they understand what he means by this is even higher. And as once consciousness disappeared, the next base, by completely surmounting the base of infinite or vanishing consciousness, aware there's nothing. Because, you know, this mind space has disappeared, consciousness has disappeared, nothing left. So you're aware there's nothing. And you enter upon abide in the base of nothingness. Now that is the other kind of pleasure or peace, loftier and more sublime than the previous pleasure. Should anyone say that is the utmost pleasure and joy that beings experience, I will not concede that to him. Why is that? Because there's another kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than nothing. So of course it's more sublime, because nothing can be, nothing can be better than nothing. So here we go. Now what is that other kind of pleasure here? Ananda, by completely surmounting the base of nothingness, the meditator enters upon and abides in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This is that other kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the previous pleasure. So again, you've already got nothingness. So you're aware there's nothingness, and then the nothingness disappears. And so you're perceiving nothing, you're not even perceiving nothing. So there's no perception going on there. But you perceive there's no perception. So what's happening, depending on whether you look at it from this angle or from that angle, it's one of those two different reference points. So from one angle, perception has stopped. From another angle, you know the perception has stopped. That's why it's neither perception nor non-perception. Should anyone say that is the utmost pleasure and joy, the utmost peace, the utmost contentment that being experiences, I have not conceded that to him. Why is that? Because there's another kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than that pleasure. And what is that other kind of pleasure? Here, Ananda, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, a meditator enters upon and abides in the cessation of all perception and feeling. Remember, the feeling here is pleasurable, painful, or neither pleasurable nor non-nor painful, all types of feeling, all types of perception. The mind has stopped. That is the other kind of pleasure, loftier and more sublime than the previous pleasure. And that's the end, where everything has stopped. That in Gautama Nikaya is called Nibbana here and now. It is possible, Nanda, that wanderers of other sects might speak thus. This recluse Gautama speaks of the cessation of perception and feeling, the cessation of everything, the cessation of mind, the cessation of consciousness. And he describes this as pleasure. What is this? How is this? Wanderers of other sects who speak thus should be told, friends, the Blessed One describes pleasure not only with reference to pleasant feeling. Rather, friends, the Tathagata describes as pleasure any kind of pleasure wherever and whatever way it is found. And that's enigmatic. Anyway, that is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, now we come to some very amazing types of pleasure. And straight away, I point out that anyone who says that doing these jhanas is all about samatha and has got no insight comes from it, you're getting a huge insight from going through this process of what happiness truly is and what real pleasure is. You're getting insight into the Four Noble Truths, into happiness and suffering. But to answer that last paragraph, when people say, this is crazy, because you talk about the cessation of perception and feeling, when the whole mind, consciousness actually stops, you describe that as pleasure, what are you talking about? So, if you can now actually get the other sutta, which we're going to read out today, 34.3, this is from the Anguttara Nikaya, the 34th sutta, it's very similar. Thus have I heard on one occasion of Venerable Sariputra, the wisest monk next to the Buddha, was dwelling at Rajagaha in a bamboo grove in a squirrel sanctuary. Then the Venerable Sariputta addressed the monk's friends. Monks. Friends, those monks replied. Venerable Sariputta said this. Happiness, friends, is this Nibbana. Happiness, friends, is this Nibbana. So, no, happiness is Nibbana. When this was said, the Venerable Udayan said to the Venerable Sariputta, again, it's the same Udayan as the previous one here. When this was said, the Venerable Udayi said to the Venerable Sariputta, but friend, Sariputta, what happiness could there be when there is nothing felt? Good question. Just this, friend, is the happiness here, that there's nothing felt. Now that's the happiness. And the Sariputta explains it. And it's very similar to what we've just gone through here. There are, friends, these five causes of sensual objects. What five? Forms cognizable by the eye, the desired, loved, agreeable, pleasing, connected with sensual pleasure, tantalizing. Sounds cognizable by the ear. Odors cognizable by the nose. Taste cognizable by the tongue. Tactile objects cognizable by the body. The desirable, loved, agreeable, pleasing, connected with sensual pleasure, tantalizing. These are the five causes of sense objects. Any pleasure or joy that arises in dependence upon these five causes of sensual pleasure is called sensual pleasure. Exactly as we had so far. Here, friends, secluded from the sense objects, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied here by thought and examination, and includes rapture and happiness born of seclusion. While the meditator is dwelling in this state, perception and attention accompanied by sensuality assail him. That is the affliction for him. Just as, friends, pain might arise for one feeling pleasure, and that would be affliction for him, so too the perception and attention accompanied by sense objects assail him, and that is the affliction for him. But the affliction is what the Blessed One has called suffering. In this way, friends, it can be understood how Nibbana is happiness. Now, what we're saying here is that you get in the jhana, and the five sense objects, gone. So that's the happiness. But then sometimes those five sense objects can come in, especially in a weak first jhana, sound. So the Buddha actually said that sound is a thorn of that first jhana. So that's why sometimes if somebody is in a deep meditation and they don't come out. There was that time, there was one of the monks just at the end of one of the retreats in North Perth. You know, he was having a nice meditation at the very end, you know, culmination of all the meditation. He was just sitting there and it was time to pack up. So, you know, we gave the blessing, we started packing up, he was still sitting there. And then we were about to go. And I said, you better do something about that young monk. He's still sitting there, hasn't moved yet. So he'd obviously got into a nice deep meditation. So the only thing you could do, you got a choice. If he was really deep, you just pick him up and put him in the car. He wouldn't know anything about it. You can do that. But, you know, I realized that, you know, it wasn't that deep. So got really close to his ear and started talking gently to him to bring him out, because it's a sound which will take you out if you're in sort of a deep meditation. So always try that. But don't shout in his ear. Rah, 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 rah. Do it nice and gently and draw him out. There's actually the story of this lady in Singapore who was in a coma. And she said it was the sound. She heard a sort of sound of a tinkling bell, and that sort of draw her out back into the real world again. Because the sound of all those five senses, that is the last one to go, and the first one to arise when you come out of these jhanas. And that's actually, you can get into the first jhana. And that particular sound, that is like the what it says here. Here, friends, while the monk is dwelling in this state, perception, attention accompanied by sense objects assail him. That's the five, that's the sense of sound usually. That is affliction for him, because you're in the jhana, now you've got that sense object. You can see that's affliction, that's a pain. So that's how nibbana is happiness, the end of an affliction. You see that sound is an affliction. Five senses are an affliction. This is why when you let them go, when you feel that affliction, then it is all gone. In the same way when a person is... Actually, there's something missing from this. In this particular sutta, it says, just like a person who's been sick and the sickness has disappeared. If I remember the sutta correctly, they had that in here. We must have missed it out in this translation. When a person is sick, when the sickness is overcome, it's a pleasure. In the same way, it's a pleasure because something which was an affliction has been let go of. And again, friends, with the subsiding of thought and examination, a meditator enters upon and applies in the second jhana. While the monk is dwelling in this state, perception and attention accompanied by this thought assail him. It's not the thought, the mind starts to move again. That is an affliction for him. You're just in the second jhana, absolutely still, and now the mind starts to move again. That's an affliction. Just as, friend, pain might arise for one feeling pleasure, and that would be an affliction for him. So too, that perception and attention accompanied by movement of the mind assailed him, and that is an affliction for him. But the affliction is what the Buddha has called suffering. In this way, the end of suffering is understood how nibbana is happiness. And again, with the fading away as well as rapture, you entered upon and dwell in the third jhana. While the bhikkhu, or the meditator, is dwelling in this state, perception and attention accompanied by rapture assail him. In other words, you move back into the second jhana, and that is an affliction for you. In that way, too, friends, it can be understood how nibbana is happiness. This is one of the weird things when you start getting into these jhanas. When you first get the first jhana, that's just the highest happiness, such bliss. When you go into the second jhana, you say, that first jhana sucks compared to the second jhana. You can't really say it sucks. I mean, that was going a bit too far. But, you know, just compared to the second jhana, oh no, just first jhana, that's not interested in that anymore. That's an affliction compared to the second jhana. So union of God, union with God, is an affliction for anyone who's got the second jhana. And again, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, a meditator enters and dwells in the fourth jhana. While the meditator is dwelling in this state, perception and attention accompanied by equanimity assail him, that is an affliction for him. In that way too, friends, it can be understood how nibbana is happiness, as ending of afflictions. With the complete transcending of perception of forms, with the passing away of perception of sensory impingement, with non-attention to perception of diversity, aware that space is unbounded, a monk enters upon and dwells in the base of the infinity or the ending of mind space. While the monk is dwelling in that state, perception and attention accompanied by forms, basically you come back again into the fourth jhana, that is an affliction for him. In this way too, friends, it can be understood how nibbana is happiness. Again, friends, by completely transcending the base of the infinity of mind space, aware that consciousness is infinite or unbounded, a monk enters and dwells in the base of the infinity or the unbounded of, or the vanishing of consciousness. While the meditator is dwelling in this state, perceptions and attention accompanied by the base of the vanishing of space assail him. That is an affliction for him. You're going backwards. In that way too, friends, it can be understood how nibbana is happiness. Again, friends, by completely transcending the base of the infinity of consciousness, aware that there's nothing, a monk enters upon and dwells in the base of nothingness, while the meditator is dwelling in this state, Perception and attention accompanied by the base of the infinity of consciousness assailed him. That is an affliction for him. In this way, too, friends, it can be understood how nirvana is happiness. Again, friends, by completely transcending the base of nothingness, a monk or meditator enters and dwells in the base of neither perception nor non-perception. While the meditator is dwelling in this state, perception and attention accompanied by the base of nothingness assail them. That is an affliction for him. In that way, too, friends, we understood how nirvana is happiness. So when these things vanish, it's a higher happiness. When you go backwards, you get these things again, and that's recognize that all these things are afflictions. And again, friends, by completely transcending the space of neither perception nor non-perception, a meditator enters and dwells in the cessation of all perception and feeling. And having seen with wisdom, this is after you emerge, your taints are utterly destroyed. In this way too, friends, it can be understood how nirvana is happiness. So nirvana is like the ending of an affliction. Happiness is the ending of afflictions. So in just the same way, when your sickness is gone, you feel happy. In the same way, when all that is to be felt and perceived has disappeared, the affliction is ceased, and that is why it's called happiness. It's a very, very profound point. If you understand that, you've gone a long way to understanding nirvana. That's why Ajahn Chah used to say, we meditate not to attain things, we meditate to let things go. Letting go. Big time. Till everything goes. Yes, the first jhana is, qualifies as Samma Samadhi, and so do all the other attainments just read out. But once you've broken through to one of those jhanas, the rest are pretty easy. Because basically from that time on you don't do anything, you just stay there. And the other jhanas just happen the longer you stay there. So? You get the hang of the practice, that's right. I know I've said this, many even monks sort of say that they argue with me. And this particular statement I'm going to make now makes it quite clear that why I teach the way I do teach. I don't really think you can truly understand what nirvana is until you've attained the first jhana. So you actually understand, see something really ceasing. See what your mind truly is. Yes, Pauline. Indeed. There is no thought and examination. This is a bad translation of the words vitakka vichara, which vitakka vichara is also used in other contexts to actually to mean thinking as we know it. But in this context, it certainly does not mean thought and examination. Indeed, it's been pointed out that in the Chinese versions of these sutras, because these sutras were preserved in the Agamas of the Mahayana tradition, and in those they do actually use different words for what's here, thought and examination, in the text of, in the context of jhana, and in the other place where it means thought. So whoever did that translation understood that contextually, it doesn't mean thought here. It's a movement of the mind, it's subverbal. It's the last time the mind is moving. Not in the way of thinking. And that's why sometimes we use the English word subverbal, so you don't formulate a word. The mind is moving, but not to the extent that you can think. Indeed. The way it's translated, remember these are English translations made by the first of the Western monks. This was mostly done by Nyanamoli, who was a great scholar, but wasn't a great meditator. So he would not have been able to speak from experience what those jhanas truly were. So a lot of times, and they did a really great job, just trying their very best to try and get it right, but we're improving it as we go along, especially as more of the translators start to get experience, and so they can understand what it really means. Yeah. Sorry, what are the... Again, because the English has never really had much facility with Buddhist concepts, especially meditation, that sometimes that we just don't have those concepts. We don't have the language to describe those contexts. So that's why, you know, it's very hard and clumsy. For me, it's like movement of the mind onto the object, is vitakka. That's not a word, that's a whole sentence. And the other one is like holding on to the object, is the vichara. It's Buddha goes to the commentator, actually did a good job. I'm sometimes critical of the commentary, but he did a good job here. He said in that context it's similar to the gong bonger, hitting the gong, that's vitakka. And the resonance, where it holds that impact, is the vichara. The mind, this is the mind, moves onto the object and it rings. In other words, you're in that bliss, then it moves away again, ring it again. That's a pretty good description. Yes, Daniel. Yeah. Yeah, if you... Okay, now this, if the question I think you're asking, what happens if you go right through all of those, it's such a powerful insight happening, because your experiences are not like thoughts. You've got this incredible data of seeing not just the five senses vanishing, but seeing your consciousness vanish, seeing it go that slowly. You can actually see its nature and see just like peeling the onion. All these little stages of meditation until you get to the center, there's nothing left. And according to how the Buddha said, and it makes total sense, that if you do go that far and you come out, there's only two possibilities, and that is either non-returner. In other words, you know, your delight in those five senses is just totally not, no delight in that anymore. Just what you have to bear with while you have a human body. But, you know, no sort of greed or hatred anymore. And the only reason why you're not fully enlightened is it's just a blissful experience. You just still hold on to the bliss of the mind. But any happiness with the five senses, you're not interested anymore. But the happiness of the mind you're still interested in. Or you see even the happiness of the mind is just an affliction. And you can let that one go too. And then you're fully enlightened. Which means because you're not attached, you're not interested in the world of the five senses, that's why you're not reborn in this five-sense world anymore. But if you're still holding on to the mind, then you'll be reborn in the mind realms. If you're not attached to anything at all, there's nothing for you to get reborn. Yeah, it moves, yeah. But you've had... The basic movement is the old karma. You've got a body, you have to eat, you have to go to the toilet. So even the Buddha had to move to go to the toilet. For the well-being of yourself and others. You got it. It's pretty much the same. The happiness you get in meditation is a happiness of peace. It means all those other things have disappeared. You don't have to perform, you don't have to move, you don't have to scratch your body or move the body. And that even bodily tranquility, where the body is just sitting here and you don't have to attend to it. You know, it's an old little trick. You just watch what people are doing, how they have to move this, scratch that. People are always moving. because the body is an uncomfortable thing to bear with, even when you're young, let alone if you're old and sick. It is the pleasure of just not having to worry about this body, because you can't feel it anymore. And you're totally aware, oh, it's just so good. Yeah, and that's exactly what it is. That's how the mind notices an affliction has disappeared. Because sometimes, you know, you just your body being so still and peaceful, and you don't have to force it, you don't have to scratch it, everything is nice and comfortable. It's the same sort of pleasure, only a bit more refined than when you first wake up in the morning. You're cozy in bed, you don't want to get out of bed. It's just so cozy in here, just, yeah, I don't have to get up yet. And then you become aware of your bladder, oh gee, I've got to get out, it's so warm and cozy in here, but it's got to go and have a pee. So whatever it is, you know, you see that the tranquility of the body is pleasure. And when your mind starts to get tranquil again, that's also more pleasure. The pleasure of peace, of contentment. It is important, but that's actually that if when you come out afterwards. Because when you go into these deep jhanas, your mind gets very powerful. And that's why, you know, the idea of having sex or the idea of, yeah, I'll go and take a nap now. You know why? Because most people, they get into deep meditation, they find they can't sleep. Well, they can lay down, but, you know, they're perfectly alert and awake because your mind is being giving a huge burst of energy. And when you have the energized mind, not only is it energized, it's not like a restless energy like having a cup of coffee. It's the energy but poised, like, you know, like a tiger about to pounce. It's huge amount of energy in its muscles, but totally still. And then if you want to sort of, whatever you want to do, that's when you ask yourself, what's my earliest memory? But you're out of the jhanas now, but just poised, energized. Then you can, the mind can move. Wherever way you direct it, then it can move. So you ask my earliest memories, and then all these old memories of early times come up. And they're fascinating. That's the time to do it. But even if you apparently, I found out that you don't have to have the full jhanas yet, even if you get close to jhana, you come out, people can sometimes get their previous existences. And that answers the question. You know, all this reincarnation business, is it true, is it not true? I just felt a break, I got to point me out to an article in the Weekend Australian by Peter Singer, and about religion and stuff. And one of the things was, he said, oh, it's obvious there's no such thing as a life after death. But he said, I might be wrong, but yeah, if he did get into some deep meditation, he'd be able to find out for himself. So it no longer is a theory, it's actually an experience, which is, you know that such a thing exists. Another time you they would choose, they wouldn't choose anything, they would just let go. It's just because they let go, they become very still. Depends on how much they let go, you know, where they start off from. It's just like a truck going down the road and you put the brakes on. When you put the brakes on, you just stop. But it takes time to stop. Depends on how much time there is of stopping, how much ceasing happens. That defines, you know, how deep you go. So if you have been having a very peaceful time, so if you know, the meditator, the arahat's been not doing very much, then you just stop and straight away they go very quickly into a jhana, they go very deep. But they've been very active. It's like the truck has been moving very fast with a heavy load on it. It's going to take a longer time to come to stillness. Maybe they won't actually come to total stillness, but they'll just be rolling along very, very slowly. And then the lights change, they have to accelerate again. Does that make sense?
It does. So, but then, suppose they always get into the sensation of the last day,
yeah.
Then how, same as what Mother said, how are they going to come out again?
It's just because they...
How are they going to, to be productive again? You know,
well, sometimes there's just... It's sometimes very difficult. But, you know, just that one example, that monk who sat for 7, 8, 9 days. So that was very productive. You know, he thought that he hadn't done anything, and he'd actually upset and disappointed all the people he was supposed to teach. You know, some of the greatest teachings are from example. And so what a wonderful productive thing it is to show that, yeah, there are still peaceful people in this world. Yeah. No, he certainly was experiencing those jhanas. I've told about that before. But no, just going according to karma. So even in those states, being in a coma, it's not sort of in a persistent vegetative state. He was obviously very aware of what was going on. So, but couldn't communicate back out. He was, yeah. That was very clear. Oh, certainly, yes.
Giving a lot more peace.
Certainly.
This is how I interpret it.
Can do. You can interpret that way. Okay, so that was a very short sutta. But as you see, very, very sort of deep. And getting into the real nitty-gritty of the deep meditation. So I hope you enjoyed it today. And I hope you go away with thinking it's not that far beyond you. Don't think, whoa, that's really way up there, nothing to do with me. Because one day you just do these things. Some retreat, you press the right button, everything gets very still. Just go for it. Okay, so thank you for listening.